Well, hello, friends. This is Tim Barnett filling in for the one and only, the extraordinary, the exceptional Amy Hall. You're listening to the hashtag STR Ask podcast, where we look at questions taken from Twitter and they're marked hashtag STR Ask, and we get Greg to give us short, concise responses. Hey, yeah, Greg.
Good luck with that.
You know, I was doing a little
short and concise.
Yeah, that's right. I was doing a little bit of research here. You know, Amy has given me some questions to ask you, and she's put about four here on the page. And when I go back and listen to the podcast, the older podcasts, you know, you guys barely get through two questions in 20 minutes. So what's going on there?
Well, you know, the way it started when Melinda was on board, remember, she was the enforcer. And part of the point of the STR Ask is to give kind of fast, rapid-fire answers here. 2 minutes, and that's where we had that little ding, as some people can remember, that dinged me out.
Yeah.
You know, I was supposed to finish by 2 minutes. And she was pretty good about enforcing that, you know. It was discomforting for me because, like a lot of speakers, you know this one, Tim, we want to tell everybody everything we know, you know. So it was frustrating. There's an advantage to trying to be concise, but I felt like maybe it was leaving out a lot of good information. So I like the newer format with Amy. We're able to meander a little bit. Actually, not meander. We're able to cover the questions a little more thoroughly. And once in a while, that means in 20 minutes, we get two questions answered, 10 minutes for our answer and conversation. I think that probably serves our people better. I'd rather have them get something more thorough than something shallow and have them get the short shrift on something important that we need to talk about. So,
yeah, well, we're going to do our best here. And if we don't cover everything, well, that'll be okay. So are you ready for the first question?
No worries. Ready to go, Tim.
Okay. This question comes from Berkulund on Twitter. And they ask, the existence of this complex universe is highly improbable, but isn't a designer mind that is capable of thinking even more complex thoughts, even more complex, and therefore even more improbable? What do you think?
Well, this question comes up quite a bit, comparing the answer to the improbable universe, which is God, with the alleged complexity of God. But here we have a kind of an equivocation. And that means that a word is used in two different ways in the discussion in a way that causes confusion or maybe even logical problems. Okay, when we say that the universe is complex, we mean in a very simple sense that it's complex. We have a lot of detail that works together in a very refined way to accomplish a particular end. Okay, mm-hmm. Think of it like a machine. Machines are complex, and because of the complexity of even the most simple machine, you think of something like origami bird that's folded in a very particular way. Maybe it has 10 or 15 folds. That is a complicated thing, though it's not that complicated. It's only 15 folds. But no one would ever suggest that a folded origami bird was the result of an accidental process. It's just, even at that level of simplicity compared to the rest of the biological world, even at that level of simplicity, it's still way too complex to happen by accident. It requires know-how to make that kind of thing. Now, I want you to keep that phrase in mind here. It requires know-how to make that kind of thing. And so what we've done is we properly inferred a creator who has the know-how to make that. And this is the basic teleological or design argument. But then the question becomes, you've basically gone out of the frying pan and into the fire, because you've got a new kind of complexity or another complexity to explain, and that is the complexity of God's mind, or the complexity of God in some sense. And this is where the word is really being used in a different way. Remember I said it takes know-how to assemble the complex artifact like an origami bird. But you see, our view is not that God was assembled at all. And in fact, the classic understanding of God is that he's not complex at all in the sense that the origami bird is complex, but he's simple. He's not made of parts. He isn't a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Let's join them together and voila, we have a God, okay? God is not assembled. He is a unified, single whole. He is an individual being, okay? And so he may have aspects to his character that we can identify, but he's a unified whole. And this question was actually directed at a different aspect of what appears to be complexity, and that is God's complex mind. But you see, minds and artifacts are two different things. I'm not even sure if the word complex is the right word to describe God's mind, except from the perspective of us beholders of God who can't figure God out. Okay, well, just because we can't figure God out, we might call that kind of complex, and I understand that. But it doesn't mean that we have a mind that's assembled of parts that is really intricate that we have to make sense of the assembler, okay? And so these are some of the ways that this kind of comparison doesn't fit. It's apples and oranges. Plus, the universe is the kind of thing that came into being. We all agree on this, whether atheist or theist, at some point in the past. And so this brings in another element. It had to be made. And to be made in this kind of complex way that we see the universe, which, by the way, complex is an understatement to describe. And you know this. This was your field before you became a speaker, Tim. It's an understatement to describe the biological realm and even the much more simple area of the physics of the universe. Each of these things are so incredibly complex that they demonstrate the hand of a designer. But when it comes to God, we don't have an assembled being of any sort. The thoughts of God's mind are maybe complex to us because we don't understand them, but they are not a complicated assemblage that requires an intelligence to put it together just that way. And that's our point about the universe, the biological realm. So this is really an apples and oranges kind of fallacy and a misunderstanding of what Christians have classically thought of as God.
This is actually the central argument of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. He kind of puts together a syllogism that really isn't sound.
It is the goofiest syllogism I have ever. It's got about 9 or 10 or 12 levels to it, and anybody thoughtfully reading it can see that this does not go through. It is, like you said, it is not valid because the collection of the points don't lead to the conclusion. Sorry for interrupting, Tim.
No, that's right. And so this and William Lane Craig has actually has a lecture on this entire topic, and he talks about the complexity of thoughts versus the simplicity of the being. Those are two different things. That's the apples and orange confusion. And of course, it doesn't explain, well, what is the best explanation of the universe at the end of the day, right? You can say, well, who designed the designer? And your designer is more complicated than the thing being designed. Even if it were true, that wouldn't disqualify the designer as the best explanation, mm-hmm. right?
That's right. Really good. It just kind of kicks the can down the road. It's kind of a tu quoque fallacy. Tu quoque is you too. Well, you have the same problem I do. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about our problem, but you still have your problem. Yeah. And your problem is explaining the complexity of the universe without a designer. This is not what they offer is not, let's put it this way, the odds-on favorite.
Yeah. Yeah, and another point that we could raise is we're not just talking about some general kind of complexity. We're talking about something very specific. In fact, this is called specified complexity or specified information. And we think the best explanation for that particular kind of complexity would point to a designer.
Right. The specified part, think of a jumble of letters. Any jumble of letters that you will construct has complexity to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got 26 letters, you have all kinds of combinations, and any particular combination is going to be highly unlikely. Okay. The difference here is not the complexity, but that the complexity is specified to something outside. It matches something. And the classic example of this is Mount Rushmore. So you have all these complex shapes. Any mountain has complex shapes. It doesn't. They're not shapes of anything. Mount Rushmore is specified to the faces of what, four former presidents? Is that right? And so we can recognize the connection there, and that is the evidence of the design. It's not just complexity. Mm-hmm. It's that the complexity is specified to something else. And what we see in the universe is complexity specified to purposes.
Yeah.
Things do things. We have things are made for particular particular things. I was talking yesterday at an interview, and I held up my Ticonderoga number 2 pencil, which I love, and I've got it in my hand right now. Well, it's clear anybody picking this up knows, well, this is made for a purpose. You might not know what the purpose is, but it's clear by looking at it, we have this design intuition. We can recognize when things are made for purposes. This is why archaeologists can tell us a natural flint from a flint that has been sharpened for the purpose of scraping or something like that. It's commonplace, so there's no reason that we shouldn't be able to legitimately apply this here. And we are not hampered by the counterargument, which ignores the first issue, as you pointed out, like Dawkins does. Well, what about you? Well, it doesn't apply to us in the same way because of the apples and oranges distinctions we were just talking about.
Yeah, that's great. All right, let's go to the second question. This is a question from Hear Us Jesus, and it says, what's STR's take on where Jesus was from the time he was emptied on the cross until the Resurrection Sunday?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he means by emptied on the cross. Generally, the phrase emptied, referring to Jesus, has to do with the incarnation, not from the death. And all that means is he was emptied of his divine prerogatives and rights, not of his deity. He was still God throughout, but he did not exercise those. He let those go. He did not grasp onto them, to use Paul's words in Philippians chapter 2. But let's just take emptied mean, in this case, died.
Yeah.
His physical body. And the question is, what is STR's take? Well, actually, STR as an organization does not weigh in on things like this because, Tim, you may have one understanding and I might have another, and that's okay, and we don't care as long as it's within the pale of orthodoxy. There are lots of different there are many people, it are many things that people disagree with me on at this organization. I'm completely comfortable with them being utterly wrong on all of those things because they don't matter that much in the big picture. We represent mere Christianity. Now, if the question is, what does Greg think or what does Tim think? To be honest, I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion about this. Pardon me. I know that some people have suggested that Jesus in the spirit, this is based on some things that were said in 1 Peter, mm-hmm. Goes to preach to the spirits in prison. That would be the demons that were imprisoned during the time of Noah. I'm not actually sure that's what the text is saying. I think there's some ambiguities there. Just in the grammar, it could be referring to something else. And I don't know that it's important. And this is one reason I don't venture there. I do know that there have been lots of errors that have cropped up that are actually are material errors when people start to speculate and come up with kind of bizarre options like Jesus went down to hell and got beat up by Satan as if hell is the place where Satan reigns.
Yeah.
Hell isn't God's domain. That's Satan's domain. He's the master of hell. It's a complete misunderstanding of the notion of hell and Satan's authority. Plus, Satan wasn't owed anything. Okay. Those bonds were broken. He wasn't paid off. You know, we were rescued out of slavery, and we were enslaved in virtue of the fact that man had a debt to God, which was paid by Christ on the cross, which is why human beings were able to be freed rescued from the slavery of sin and the slavery of Satan. But the word faith movement, the so-called word faith movement, has gotten creative here with these kinds of things and extended their theology to that dark time between the death of Christ and the resurrection, and speculated on a lot of things that have led them astray. So I'm generally not one to speculate too much on things that aren't really crystal clear or pretty clear in Scripture, because it's a waste of time and it leads to problems. And I think this is an example of that. If the Scripture speaks to it, even if vaguely, we can weigh in with what we think it's talking about, but we just have to be careful we don't hang on too tightly to those things, and certainly not construct controversial doctrines out of vague passages.
Yeah, I think the principle here is we want to interpret the clear the unclear in light of what we know from the clear, right?
Right.
And there are certain things we do know. We know that it is finished on the cross. And so there isn't Jesus going to hell or something to pay something to Satan. That's silly. We know that, you know, Jesus turns to the thief on the cross and says, "Today you'll be with me in paradise."
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a sense in which, well, Jesus is in paradise. And then of course there's this strange passage, 1 Peter 3, which, I mean, yeah, maybe he went and proclaimed something to, I mean, the demons, or these spirits, I guess, in prison, being held in chains. And there's a lot of speculation on what exactly that means, connecting back to what was going on in Noah's day. Maybe, you know, you could start talking about the Nephilim getting involved in all of this. And, I mean, this, I just don't know if we can be real dogmatic about this. So let's go with what we know, the clear, and then we'll try and make sense of the unclear.
To give you an idea of the ambiguity in 1 Peter 3, I'm just going to go back for a moment. Starting in verse 18, Peter writes, "For Christ died for sins once for all," good news, "the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison," or in prison. Now, all that verse says is that in the Spirit, he went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison. It doesn't say when that happened. Now, it is connected with the death of Christ here, and so it might be referring to after he died, he made proclamation. And these were the disobedient spirits during the days of Noah, okay? But it might be referring to the fact of Jesus doing something, making a proclamation to those spirits who are now in prison, but maybe weren't then. Mm-hmm. When he made proclamation, and that proclamation might have been made through Noah,
yeah,
through the preaching of Noah at the time, motivated by the Spirit of Christ. So, you know, maybe, maybe not.
Okay, let's do one more in the last minute or two here. This is from Ian, and it says, "What do you say to someone who says all the writings of the Apostle Paul can't be trusted as God's inspired word?"
Well, I guess the question I would ask is, why does that person think that the writings of Paul can't be trusted? What's curious about the Pauline epistles, when you discuss the question of canon, is as far as what books belong in the Bible. As far as the early church was concerned, and these are the group of people that were closest to the apostolic witness, as far as the early church was concerned, this is just a matter of historical record, if they were confident that the epistle was Pauline, that Paul had authored it, discussion was over.
Yeah.
It belongs in the canon. Mm-hmm. So there, virtually universally, in the early church, they recognized Paul as a legitimate apostle. Now, this, of course, doesn't exclude the idea that there were smaller groups that challenged his apostleship. And so in, say, 2 Corinthians and maybe other places, he defended his apostleship. And he said, look, I have all the marks of an apostle. I was a witness to the risen Christ. I was chosen by Christ himself to spread this message. I show the evidence of powers, works of powers and signs and wonders and everything to demonstrate or authenticate my apostleship. And not only that, but he makes it clear in Galatians that he was received by the core, Peter, James, and John, and he tested his gospel against theirs, and they were the pillars of the church, and they received him openly. And even Peter in 2 Peter makes reference to Paul's writings indirectly as scripture. He says that, sometimes he writes things that are hard to understand, and the untaught and the unstable distort as they do the rest of the scripture. So what's interesting here is we have a record, we have the general consensus of the early church, the very early church, who are very close to the authorities in question, who acknowledged hands down that Pauline epistles were canon. They were rule. They were the authority to speak for God. And then we have Peter's remark in 2 Peter that identifies Paul's writing as scripture. We have the testimony of the early church. Let's put it this way. I don't see any good reason to doubt that Paul's writings are scripture. Mm-hmm. And every reason to affirm it. So I don't know where this rationale is coming from. That's the problem. People can make any claims they want, but giving reasons why we ought to take the claims seriously, that's another issue.
That's great. I think that's all the time that we have for today. Remember, folks, if you have a question that you want us to respond to, hop on Twitter with the hashtag #STRAsk. And we'll do our best to respond. This is Tim Barnett filling in for Amy Hall with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Thanks for listening.